All right. Welcome, everyone, to another deep dive. Today, we're looking at something really interesting. It's where contract law and fraud kind of bump into each other. And specifically, how courts handle these clauses you see in contracts that are supposed to stop someone from later saying, hey, you tricked me.
Right. Exactly. Trying to basically contract your way out of accountability.
Yeah. Can you really just put some words on paper and that makes lying okay?
Well, that's what we're going to find out. This is a tricky area, lots of nuances.
For sure. And to really dig into this, we've got a fantastic case.
Oh, yeah, a classic.
From the New York Court of Appeals, it's Dinan Realty Corp.
Oh.
Well, the defendant's name isn't super important here.
No, not for our purposes today.
But the case itself, Dinan Realty, that's a must read for anyone dealing with contracts.
Absolutely essential, especially if you're handling big deals, property transactions, that sort of thing.
Because what this deep dive boils down to is, can a carefully worded clause protect someone who's made, well, let's call them fraudulent statements?
Right. Flat out lies.
Exactly. If someone lies to get you to sign, can they then point to the contract itself and say, nope, not my problem?
That's the question.
Yeah. And to get to the bottom of this, we've got some great sources. We've got our podcast guidance notes, of course.
Always helpful for overview.
Then there's this perplexity analysis.
Yeah.
Which initially it pointed out we were missing some key details about the case.
Right. We needed more specifics.
But now we've got the full legal brief of Dinan Realty itself.
The good stuff.
So we're ready to go deep.
Let's do it.
Okay. So first things first, what exactly happened in Dinan? Give us the facts of the case.
All right. So basically, you've got Dinan Realty Corporation. They bought this lease on a building.
Okay. Pretty standard stuff.
Yeah. But then after the deal's done, Dannon's claiming they were tricked.
Tricked how?
Well, they say the seller, the person they bought the lease from, lied about two big things. The building's operating expenses and how much profit it was bringing in.
So they're saying those were misrepresented, those numbers.
Exactly. And that these lies were what convinced them to buy in the first place.
Classic fraud claim setup.
Right. But here's the twist. The contract they signed had this really specific disclaimer clause.
Ah, okay, this is where it gets juicy. What did this clause say?
So it said, flat out, that Dinan was not relying on any representations made outside the written contract.
So anything said verbally, any promises, those didn't matter?
Nope, according to the contract. And it gets even more specific. The clause actually lists out these categories, like the physical condition of the property, the rents, the leases, expenses, how it's operated, basically anything that could affect the building's value.
Wow, they really covered their bases, huh?
Oh, yeah. And there's even a part that says Dinan had inspected the property and knew what they were getting into.
So the seller's basically saying, hey, you agreed to rely only on this paper, not my words.
Exactly.
Okay, so what happened next? Did this clause work?
Well, initially, yeah. The trial court actually sided with the seller, said Dinan's fraud claim was a no-go.
Because of that clause.
Because of that clause, yep. But then things took a turn. The appellate division reversed that decision, said the claim could go forward.
Oh, so back and forth already. Where did it end up?
At the top, the New York Court of Appeals. They're the final word in New York.
Big leagues. So what was the big question for them to decide? What was the legal issue at the heart of it all?
It was this. Can this super specific disclaimer clause really block someone from suing for fraud, even when it's about the exact stuff the disclaimer says you're not relying on?
Okay, so rewind back to what Dinan was claiming. Those expenses and profits, the court had to decide if that clause could protect the seller from those specific accusations.
Exactly.
And what did they say? What was the majority opinion?
So the majority, led by Judge Burke, they said, nope, that disclaimer works. They reversed what the appellate division said and went back to the trial court's dismissal.
They sided with the seller.
Yep. And their reasoning, it all came down to how specific that disclaimer was.
Right. We talked about how detailed it was.
It's not just a general merger clause like, oh, this paper is the whole deal. Forget anything we said before. This one targeted the exact things Dinan was crying foul about, those expenses and profits.
So because it was so precise, it actually held up.
Yep. The court basically said, look, Dinan, you signed this, you agreed to it. You can't now say you did rely on those outside statements.
Legally, they were stopped, right? Like they were blocked from making that claim.
Exactly, stopped. Mm-hmm. The court's view was you agreed you weren't relying on those statements. End of story.
Seems kind of harsh, but I guess that's contracts, right? Black and white.
Well, not always. The majority did carve out an exception.
Oh.
Yeah, they said this kind of specific disclaimer might not work if what was misrepresented was, and I'm quoting here, peculiarly within one party's knowledge.
Meaning what? The seller knew something Danan couldn't have reasonably found out on their own.
Exactly. Like some hidden defect. Something that requires more than just ordinary intelligence to uncover.
So if the seller was hiding something truly sneaky, the clause might not protect them.
Right. That brings in an element of fairness. You can't just contract away accountability for hiding crucial info.
Makes sense. Mm. But overall, did the majority seem to think these disclaimers are powerful tools?
Oh, yeah. They even said, and this is a direct quote, "If the language here used is not sufficient to stop a party from claiming that he entered the contract because of fraudulent representations, then no language can accomplish that purpose."
Wow. So they're basically saying if this doesn't work, nothing will.
Pretty much. They're giving a lot of weight to these specific disclaimers. This case has been hugely influential, by the way, on how contracts are written and interpreted since then.
I bet. Okay, so that's the majority, but what about the other side? Was anyone dissenting?
Oh, yeah. Judge Fuld had a strong dissent. His whole argument rested on this idea that fraud vitiates every agreement which it touches.
Meaning you can't contract your way out of being a fraud.
Exactly. He said no matter how fancy the wording, if there's fraud, that trumps everything.
So for him, this whole idea that you can sign away your right to sue for fraud, that was a no-go.
Huge no-go. He even raised a big public policy concern, said allowing these disclaimers could basically give dishonest sellers a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Like it would incentivize lying because they know they're protected.
Right. This really highlights the tension between freedom of contract, like you can agree to anything, versus deterring bad behavior in the marketplace.
Yeah, you want to hold contracts, but not if they're tools for fraud.
Yeah.
So we've got this clash, certainty and predictability in deals versus preventing dishonesty.
Exactly. And Judge Fuld put it really well. He said, "The law should not and does not permit a covenant of immunity to be drawn that will protect a person against his own fraud. Such is not enforceable because of public policy."
So he's saying the law has to prioritize stopping fraud, even if it means going against what's written in the contract.
Yep. That's a strong stance.
This really shows how two legal minds can look at the same situation and come to very different conclusions.
Absolutely. And for our law students listening, this case is a perfect example of how legal principles can collide and how judges weigh those principles differently.
It's not always cut and dry, is it?
Not at all.
So with all this in mind, what are the big takeaways from Danan? What should people be looking for when dealing with these disclaimer clauses, especially in situations where fraud might be an issue?
All right. So based on Danan, there are two key things courts are going to scrutinize. First, like we've been talking about, is specificity.
How detailed is that clause? How clearly does it address the exact misrepresentations being claimed?
Exactly. Vague, general disclaimers, those are weak. You want something laser focused on the specific areas where the buyer says they were misled.
So if you're drafting these things, be precise, spell it out.
Absolutely. Don't leave any wiggle room.
Okay. And what's the second big factor?
It's the knowledge imbalance between the parties. Could the buyer, using ordinary intelligence, have figured out the truth on their own?
Right. Did they have a reasonable way to verify what the seller was saying?
Exactly. Or was the seller hiding something that the buyer had absolutely no way of finding out? That gets into the fairness issue. One side shouldn't be able to hide crucial information and then use a contract to escape the consequences.
So it's about access to information, who knew what, and could the buyer have reasonably uncovered the truth?
Precisely.
This all has some pretty practical implications.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the one writing the contract, you need to make those disclaimers ironclad, super specific.
Absolutely.
But if you're the one signing the buyer, you can't just take the seller's word for it. You got to do your homework.
Due diligence is key, especially on big points. Don't just rely on promises. Verify, verify, verify. Because Danan shows us that disclaimer might actually work, and then you're stuck.
Makes you think. Let's say, just hypothetically, a seller knows there's asbestos in property. Nasty stuff.
Uh-oh.
But the contract has this super specific disclaimer saying the buyer isn't relying on any representations about the condition of the property. Would that clause protect the seller in that case?
Well, that gets right to the heart of that exception the majority carved out. Remember, they said it might not apply if the facts were peculiarly within one party's knowledge.
And asbestos, that's not something most buyers would just stumble upon, right?
Right. That could very well be considered something the seller uniquely knew, something not discoverable through ordinary inspection. So, Danan suggests that in a case like that, that disclaimer wouldn't be enough to shield the seller.
So even with a super specific disclaimer, there are limits.
Absolutely. But of course, every case is unique. It would be up to the court to decide if those specific facts met the legal standard.
Okay, so before we wrap up, let's recap some of the big points from our deep dive into Dannon.
Good idea.
First off, remember the difference between a general merger clause and a specific disclaimer. One just says this contract is the whole deal. The other says you're not relying on anything outside of it.
And it's that specific disclaimer that has the teeth when it comes to potential fraud claims.
Right. And it was interesting how the majority used the contract language to basically negate the reliance element of fraud.
Yeah. Usually you have to prove you relied on a false statement, but here they said the contract itself could eliminate that reliance. That's a pretty unique application of contract law.
It is. And then we have this underlying policy tension we keep coming back to.
The balance between upholding contracts and making sure people aren't rewarded for being dishonest, that's the real struggle here.
Dannon really shows us that conflict in action.
It does.
So, final takeaway for our listeners, what's the big lesson about these disclaimers and fraud?
Even the most carefully written disclaimer, it's not a magic shield. It has limits, especially when there's a big knowledge gap between the parties and the seller was hiding something important.
Specificity matters, and so does the buyer's ability to find the truth on their own. This all makes you wonder, where does the responsibility really lie? Is it all on the buyer to be super suspicious and investigate everything? Or is the seller always obligated to be honest, even if they try to write that responsibility away in the contract?
That's a tough one, a question that goes beyond any single case. It gets to the heart of ethics and how we expect people to behave in business dealings.
Really makes you think. If anyone wants to explore this more deeply, I highly recommend checking out Judge Fuld's dissent in Dannon.
Oh, absolutely, a must read.
It's a great example of strong legal reasoning based on public policy concerns, and it offers a really compelling counterpoint to the majority's view.
It definitely challenges you to think about the big picture, the ethical implications of these kinds of situations where contracts and fraud intersect.
Well, on that note, that's our deep dive for today. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, and keep exploring the fascinating world of law.